I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. This month marks the 50th anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery voting rights marches, with the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. leading the way. Thousands of people of all faiths and races flocked to Alabama over several days to protest the disenfranchisement of African American voters in the South. Black voters were often turned away from the polls, harassed, or subjected to literacy tests before being allowed to vote. In this edition of Midday, we speak to Unitarian minister and historian Mark Morrison Reed about Selma, including the events of Bloody Sunday and the murder of the Reverend Jim Reeb. And we'll hear a firsthand account from activist Charles Blackburn, a Baltimorean and former minister who once organized marches in Alabama. Selma at 50, after the news. Good afternoon, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. You're listening to a recording of people in Selma, Alabama, in 1965, singing at a funeral service for Jimmie Lee Jackson, an Army veteran from nearby Marion, Alabama, who was beaten by Alabama state troopers and shot by one of them. That happened in February 1965, and the death of Jimmie Lee Jackson inspired events of March 1965 in Selma, Alabama. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and activists from the Southern Leadership Conference arrived in the state ready to kick off their efforts to fight discriminatory voter registration practices. African Americans who came to the polls were regularly harassed, turned away, or subjected to literacy tests in which they could be asked to recite passages from the U.S. Constitution before being allowed to vote. Thousands of protesters of all races and religions arrived from across the country. They were met by Alabama state troopers who attacked them. Protesters were beaten with whips and clubs and subjected to tear gas. The events of Selma led President Lyndon Johnson to call for comprehensive voting rights legislation. In a speech to a joint session of Congress, March 15, 1965, LBJ said, "There is no Negro problem, there is no Southern problem, there is no Northern problem, there is only an American problem. It is wrong, deadly wrong, to deny any of your fellow Americans the right to vote in this country. There is no issue of states' rights or national rights, there is only the struggle for human rights." The Voting Rights Act was signed into law in August of 1965. Today, as the 50th anniversary of the Selma marches approaches, we are joined by Unitarian Universalist minister and historian, the Reverend Mark Morrison Reed, who is on a national tour with his latest book, The Selma Awakening, it's called, about his denomination's activism in Selma. So, Mark Morrison Reed, Reverend Reed, Morrison Reed, it's nice to have you on the Midday Show with
us. Thank you, Dan. Good to be here.
And also with us is Charles Blackburn, a Baltimorean, former minister and civil rights activist. Charles Blackburn participated in the marches in Selma. He was also arrested prior to the events of Selma for trying to register African-American voters in Magnolia, Mississippi. So we'll hear about his experiences during this hour as well. Charles Blackburn, nice to have you on the show with us.
Thank you, Dan.
You heard that song from being sung at the funeral service for Jimmie Lee Jackson. That's a recording produced by Carl Benkert, who was an interior designer from Detroit, who brought a camera and a reel-to-reel tape recorder to Selma to document the demonstrations. He also served as night watchman for the marchers. And I mention that because Benkert's album has been preserved by the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage, and we got it from there. So I'm going to start the story there, though, because I'd like to hear a little bit of that history, the death of Jimmie Lee Jackson, and how that pushed people to the march in Selma.
So the marching had begun already at the end of January, and they had the SCLC. And then we need to be clear, the SNCC had already been in Selma, so the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee had been there already for 2 years, organizing the community, building on the work that Amelia Boynton and her husband had done even prior to that. one of the rallies then took place in Marion on an evening, and that was rudely broken up by the state police. And in the frenzy and the chaos, Jimmie Lee Jackson's effort to protect his grandfather, he was beaten and he was shot in the stomach and didn't die immediately. Unlike the movie, he actually lingered on for almost a week before he died.
And Dr. King visited him in the hospital, I read, and then spoke at his funeral.
Right.
You reference in your book, The Selma Awakening, Charles Blackburn, right after this. In the chronology there, Charles Blackburn, I guess it's at this time you ought to tell us about what you were doing in Alabama in February 1965 when you got a phone call about the death of Jimmie Lee Jackson.
I had been called to the Unitarian Universalist Church in Huntsville, Alabama, as their first minister, and they probably they might have been the last minister as far as they were concerned, in the summer of 1964. And so I had been tested a little before this Jimmie Lee Jackson events occurred with the voter registration drive in Mississippi. We can get into that later if you'd like to. But I got a call from Joseph Ellwanger, a very courageous white Lutheran minister in Birmingham, who was born in Selma and had been very concerned and upset by what was going on there and the brutality in the jail particularly. And he called and said that he was organizing a group of concerned white citizens of Alabama. It sounds too much like some of the other organizations to me, the other kind.
Mm-hmm.
And would I please bring some people from Huntsville? So I got there were 15 of us from my church, and we met the next day on March 6th, the day before Bloody Sunday. 72 of us, 36 were Unitarians, and we marched on the courthouse. It turns out that we were very fortunate that it was the city controller of the police that was in control that day, whereas on the next day, on Bloody Sunday, it was the state person who was. Mm-hmm. In any event, we were met by jeering crowds and Dixie, and we sang America to boost our courage. And then the blacks broke out into We Shall Overcome and gave us a great boost. Afterwards, it was very interesting in a black church. James Bevel of SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, gave a stirring talk. And he said that he was just dumbfounded when he saw these whites marching for civil rights, Alabamians. He said, "Damn, the kingdom is coming." And then afterwards, another speaker praised us at first and then said, "But where have you been?"
Hmm. Well, that sort of gets to the essence of your book, doesn't it, Reverend Mark Morrison Reed? The subtitle, How the Civil Rights Movement Tested and Changed Unitarian Universalism. You call this the Selma Awakening.
Right. So we think of ourselves as liberal, and we think we should have been there and assume, since we'd been at the March on Washington, there was almost, 1,600 there, that we were always on the right side of this issue. But if you look deeper into our history, that isn't the case. And so it was a sort of awakening that I go back and try to explain what brought us to the response that came forth. That, I mean, Charles was there the day before. So Charles was there already on March 6th.
Before Bloody Sunday.
Bloody Sunday was March 7th. And then the Unitarians and Lutherans and Catholics and Episcopalians all started arriving on the evening of March 8th to participate on the March 9th march. We were often not in the... You couldn't get settled if you were an African-American minister. Our congregations that were in the inner city were moving out into the suburbs. If you looked at the religious education material within Unitarian Universalism, you couldn't find a black person or reference to George Washington Carver or anything. So if you looked at it, you have to wonder why we went. And so that's the question I was occupying myself, is why did we go? I was trying to explain that, and I'll talk some more about
that. How much of a presence did the Unitarian Universalist Church have in the South generally?
Small.
Very small. Well, yes.
Charles can speak to that.
How unusual was it, was your situation?
We were very, very small groups, and the only reason that one could exist in Huntsville, Alabama, was the space program. There were a lot of engineers from all over the country. So you would see where there was a university or something of that sort to an intellectual climate, you would find a small group of Unitarians, many times without ministers at all.
Your book talks about this awakening. In other words, what brought it about? Was it did it reach the point where it took the death of Jimmie Lee Jackson to get?
No, it wasn't. Actually, it wasn't Jimmie Lee Jackson's death. The trigger, I think I don't know if people know this. So the movie makes believe that they kind of they filmed what was going on and then beamed it up like we do nowadays. they filmed it and they sent the reels up to New York. So it was evening by the time the reels got to NBC, ABC, CBS.
Right.
And they were watching that evening judgment at Nuremberg. So it was about the Nazi war trials. And they interrupted that drama with Spencer Tracy, for those who remember, to show...
You mean on network television?
Yes, on network television, to show the beatings in Selma. In our own country. So all of a sudden, people could see that the Nazis, it wasn't about Germany, and it wasn't 20 years ago. The stormtroopers were right here in America, and there was any confusion people had was dispelled in that moment. The next morning, then, King sent out a telegram around 4:57 in the morning to all the major denominations saying, we're going to have another march on March 9th, send clergy. So that was the beginning of the response. What happened then, though, and this is fascinating, it arrived on Dana McLean Greeley's desk. I was our president, and he wrote in the note, side of the note, something like, call out our men. And so they got on the phones and started calling around.
Meaning the pastors?
And these would have been officials. These would have been officials at the headquarters in Boston. Mm-hmm. And they started just calling. One was Orloff Miller, who was head of the campus ministry program. He started calling all the campus ministries. The Mass Bay district representative started calling all the ministers into Mass Bay. They just routinely started calling mostly ministers on the East Coast and saying, go to Selma.
And so, James Reeb was one of them.
So James Reeb, fascinatingly, had dinner with Ted Webb, which doesn't mean anything.
Wait a minute. Let's tell folks who James Reeb was.
Okay,
out a name.
Go ahead. Okay.
Well, some people may know his name.
Right,
You mentioned Orloff, too, is another one we have to talk about.
Right.
But James Reeb was a Unitarian Universalist minister who was moved to go to Selma. But
Right.
So my little bit of it. You tell us
okay,
more,
Okay, so a little
please.
More. So James Reeb was completely committed to African-American liberation and empowerment and had worked in Washington, D.C. as a parish minister and had decided he needed to be more deeply engaged in the community, had moved to Boston into Dorchester, lived in an African-American white family, four children, lived in a black community, sent his kids to predominantly black schools, and was working in that community on issues of housing and education. He was completely committed. He was with one of the UUA people that evening for dinner when they watched this on television. That was the person who the next day called him and said, Jim, we need you to go to Selma. He then went home. He and his wife had an argument. They did not see eye to eye on this. She says, why you? Why not someone else? It was clear he felt completely compelled to go. That played itself out over and over again. And so Orloff Miller, so what we need to know is when James Reeb, on that day of the march, on March 9th, they went on the march, they turned around at the bridge and came back, and then a bunch of them went out to dinner. So James Reeb was with Orloff Miller, who I already mentioned, and then Clark Olson. Another Unitarian minister. He was from Berkeley and got there a little late, but he got there in time to go to dinner with his buddies. Interestingly, the three of them, actually why they sat down together was because they all worked on campus ministry. Clark was getting ready to take a group to Russia. And they were all quite curious. I mean, it was quite normal stuff. But
sure.
That's why they sat together. They came out and they turned to the right into the white section of town, and that's when they were attacked. Reeb was on the curbside. That's why Reeb took the brunt of the hit by the club or the or board. Then Orloff was beaten to the ground, kicked in the face and the head. He still has, I just saw him, he still has the mark on his forehead. And Clark was the furthest away and was roughed up and had his glasses broken. And but
Reverend Reeb took a terrible beating
to the head.
He
was stunned.
Right?
He just took a huge and was out on the ground. And they finally got him up, and it got clear fairly quickly that he was in terrible shape.
He did not die right away.
No, it was another
couple of days.
2 days later, I think.
James Reeb. I posted photographs on our Facebook page of Jimmie Lee Jackson, who was killed in February, or died in February. He was killed in February. And the Reverend James Reeb, who was inspired to go to Alabama, to Selma, for the marches. We'll take a break here on Midday and come back and talk some more to the Reverend Mark Morrison Reed, author of The Selma Awakening, How the Civil Rights Movement Tested and Changed Unitarian Universalism. And we'll speak some more with Charles Blackburn about what it was like to be a minister in Alabama, a Unitarian minister in Alabama, during the time of the marches. And as we go into the break, we're listening to the marchers, the Selma to Montgomery marches, singing We Shall Not Be Moved Again, a recording from the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage.
We shall not be moved. Yes, yeah, the violet. We shall not be moved just like a tree that's planted by the water. Oh, we shall not be moved. Freedom, freedom, freedom.
Everybody wants freedom. Some of the marches in Selma, again, a recording from the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage. As we approach the 50th anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery marches that went on for several days, several weeks in March, I was speaking in this hour with the Reverend Mark Morrison Reed, who is visiting Baltimore. He's on a national book tour with a book that he's written about his denomination's activism in Selma, Alabama, called The Selma Awakening, How the Civil Rights Movement Tested and Changed Unitarian Universalism. And the Reverend Morrison Reed will be speaking in Baltimore tonight, and we'll tell you about that during this hour of the show. It's at the First Unitarian Church of Baltimore. And Charles Blackburn is with us, who is a former Unitarian minister, but actually, before that, you grew up in a different denomination. You grew up Methodist, is that right?
Yes, in the Southern Methodist Church in northern Florida in the early 1930s. It couldn't get much more southern than that.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were gentle, kind people, but very paternalistic. The only blacks we had any interaction with at all was washwomen and church sextons and that sort of thing. We didn't know there was such a thing as an educated black. And it was a tremendous shock to me when I arrived in Washington some years later, and I went to hear Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speak in Howard University Chapel in 1958. And it was such a profound impact on me that I decided to enter Howard University. My wife was a sixth-generation South Carolinian. I was a fourth-generation Floridian. And I just wanted to know, what's this all about? What have I missed all these years?
Is that why you went to Howard to hear Dr. King?
Yes.
Had you been in divinity school?
I had started studying for the Unitarian ministry in the Washington area at that time. So then I studied sociology of the Negro with Dr. E. Franklin Frazier and entered the graduate school of religion as the only Caucasian for a year before going out to California, getting my degree, and having my first church where I set up a Black Studies program, worked in integrated housing, and set up a core chapter. And then Martin Luther King once again spoke 1963 from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. and the bombing of the church in Birmingham, and my wife and I said, we should return to the South, not with crusading zeal, but perhaps we can be more effective as Southerners. Well, it turns out that's not the way it works. There's anything a Southerner despises more than a Yankee, it's a turncoat Southerner. So I accepted the position in Huntsville, and we were—
With the Unitarian Church.
With the Unitarian Church, yes.
Okay, I skipped a step there. So you realize, that's okay, you realize you couldn't do this as a Methodist minister?
Oh, long ago I'd realized that.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. I just want to make that clear to our listeners. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So anyhow—
So you joined the unit. What attracted to you to Unitarian Universalism?
Dr. A. Powell Davies at All Souls Church in Washington. I heard him speak on the McCarthy business. I attended the Army McCarthy hearings in the spring of 1954. That's when I became Unitarian.
But why? What was it about that? There was a spirit of activism, awareness of your times?
I had just never been exposed to progressive thought at all until 1954.
Okay.
And I just became curious about anything, all these issues that I had not really questioned at all in the South.
So in growing up, if you heard a sermon from a Methodist minister, it didn't speak to his times, didn't speak to social problems, or no?
Not very deeply, certainly. And I remember being very proud of my father, however, because the arch segregationists called the circuit riders came around interviewing six candidates for bishop to make them sign a pledge of segregation forever, and my father refused to sign it and lost the election for bishop. So
What happened to his ministry as a result
of
that?
He had a very, very fine ministry, but
was
no
there
more.
Any consequence to that? In terms of his ministry?
Well, yes. I mean, becoming a bishop in the Methodist Church is a really big deal.
Well, that didn't happen. What about his own flock?
He had a tremendous ability to build new churches and to save old churches. And so instead of rewarding him with well-functioning good churches, they would give him failed churches, which he would then make thriving ones.
Charles Blackburn, would you take us to Huntsville then? Alabama, 1964.
July of 64.
I want to throw just one thing
ahead,
about Charles.
Yes.
That going to Howard cost him his job. So he was fired because he chose to go to Howard School of Religion.
Okay. I didn't pick that up from the
story. No, it's not in the book. I just found this out when we were just talking before we walked in here.
So you were a Methodist, but by going to Howard, you were forfeiting your...
No. He was working for a senator from Florida.
Senator Spencer
Holland.
Oh,
we skipped this one. We skipped this part.
Yeah,
okay.
And when he heard that I was going to Howard University, he said, you have your choice of leaving Howard or leaving my employ.
This was, which senator
this
was this?
Senator Spessard Holland of Florida in 1950.
A U.S. senator.
U.S. senator. Fraternity brother of my father's at Emory, and that's how I'd gotten my job. So I told my Unitarian minister that I'd been fired. He called the moderator of the American Unitarian Association, who was the wife of Senator Paul Douglas, and she said, you put that young man to work. In 24 hours, I had a job again.
Oh, so that's how you moved to Unitarian Universalism.
No, he was already Unitarian.
You're already headed there, but they gave you a job.
Right.
Okay. Let's go to Huntsville, Alabama, please. I need to know what life was like there for you.
All right. Well, the fear started before I even got there. Driving there, we had to cross a corner of Mississippi, and we were told, do not get out of your car for any reason. We had California license plates. We were suspect. It was the first summer of freedom schools in Mississippi. We drove for 100 miles across the corner of Mississippi, just under 55 miles an hour. The troopers followed us from the west border of the state to the east border. Then we got to Birmingham, spent the night with my uncle and aunt there. And my aunt got hold of some picture albums from our car, and we had just attended a wedding in Detroit, of black friends of mine from Howard. The next morning, my aunt said to me, Charles, I love you, but I love my father, my husband more. You will never again be welcome in our home. And she kept her word. So we began to learn what it would mean to be a Unitarian in Alabama at this time. Then I got to Huntsville, and just 6 weeks after arriving there, the end of Freedom Summer and early September in Macomb, Mississippi, there were a number of churches that were bombed, a number of houses that were torched, and SNCC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, were trying to get some attention focused on the plight of the people in Macomb. So they got the National Council of Churches to help them get ministers to come for a voter registration drive in Macomb. I was the only Southern minister who came. There were 17 Northern rabbis and ministers. We arrived, we took blacks to register to vote. I had a 94-year-old black Baptist minister and his wife. We were arrested for trespassing on the courthouse grounds, thrown in jail. The holding cell for the minister and I was stacked with filthy mattresses, with roaches on the ceiling of the cell. But they were horrified to discover an hour later that they had integrated their own jail. A little humor in all of this blackness. We were in jail for 48 hours. Fortunately, Drew Pearson,
yeah,
the syndicated columnist, mm-hmm, was focusing attention on Macomb and Magnolia at that time. And so he called the senators of the Northern ministers who were in jail, and they called J. Edgar Hoover, who very reluctantly sent two FBI agents down to interview us in the jail. And as a result, we were released after 48 hours. But it was more frightening when we were let out than when we were in.
After that, did you feel like you had to watch out for yourself? You had to be very careful about your activities.
Absolutely. It turns out that one of my neighbors in Huntsville, when I returned to Huntsville, was the daughter of the sheriff of Magnolia, Mississippi, and she tried to burn a cross on our lawn to welcome me back. So that was the signal, we've got the bead on your target for the next 2 years.
Aside from that, were you threatened any other time?
Yes. After the March 25th march into Montgomery, my picture appeared on the front page of the Huntsville Times, and it was sort of target, get this guy. And that night, the church was stoned. The windows were shattered of the church school. 250 threatening and obscene phone calls while my wife was sitting home with a 10-month-old daughter. The Klan reorganized in Huntsville, had a rally a block from our house. We had heavy wire mesh screens over the windows, floodlights on the corners of the house, and checked for bombs under the hood of the car. And this went on for months.
Do you remember driving in the toward the center of the road to make it harder to be run off the road?
That was one
of the
instructions.
Is that one of the things you did?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, Charles Blackburn, again, it's nice to have you on the show telling these stories, but you mentioned your wife. How did she do through all of this, and what was she like? What was her attitude about all this? Totally supportive?
Supportive, but scared to death. I was involved. I had adrenaline going. I wasn't nearly as frightened as she was at home, and she nearly lost her mind. After 2 years, we had to move to New York.
You're listening to Midday. Selma Plus 50 is our theme in this hour of the show, as we tell you about the March, Selma to Montgomery March. As that anniversary approaches, we thought we'd talk about it. And the perspective here is the Unitarian Universalist Church, because that's where Charles Blackburn was a minister, and Mark Morrison Reed is a minister and a historian of Unitarian Universalism, and has written a book called The Selma Awakening. So I want to go back to that and draw a little bit more of the picture of Unitarians in the South and how unusual Charles Blackburn was at that time. Just to go back over what we mentioned earlier, those who got involved in the Selma March came from elsewhere.
Largely.
But there was a presence there. These churches
in Birmingham,
did exist.
Well, yeah. Birmingham, Montgomery, and Huntsville. That's it.
Cities,
that was it for Alabama. There was some small universalist churches, but that was it, really, the cities.
And I want to go back to James Reeb just mm-hmm. for a moment. Minister, Reverend Reeb, who was killed March 9th?
He was March 9th, he was clubbed, yeah, and he died 2 days later.
What was the reaction to his death?
More people came down. There was shock. There was a memorial service held there on the following Monday. The UUA board of the Unitarian Universalist Association had been meeting in Boston. It adjourned its meeting and moved it to Selma, Alabama, reconvening in the Catholic Church there, the Catholic Mission there. 109 ministers came down specifically for his memorial service. There was subsequently another memorial service in Washington, D.C. at All Souls Church, and yet a third memorial service at in Boston. In fact, there were services and marches across the country in response to his death. The response to his death was nothing like that of Jimmie Lee Jackson. You couldn't find a mention, perhaps a local mention of his death. The response to Reeves' death was a whole nother category.
Even the president reacted.
Even the president reacted.
May I speak to that?
Go ahead, Charles.
I was in the hospital in Birmingham while Jim was dying, and I helped handle the press, and I got the message from President Johnson. It was a remarkably personal, very profound response. And the arch segregationists were so overwhelmed at the revulsion of this act that they started putting out that Jim was an intentional martyr to the cause, that he had been set up. And the fact that he was working in a ghetto in Boston, you could almost believe it, but that's...
When you say Jim, you're referring to Jim Reeves, just to make it clear.
Right.
But the Jimmie Lee Jackson who died, was a black man who died in February, a month earlier, and there just wasn't this national reaction.
No reaction.
Yeah, really, virtually none, huh?
None.
Right.
There was one partial explanation for that. There was no media results came out of that Marion, Alabama march because the lights were turned off in the city, the cameras were sprayed with paint, lights were smashed. There was not a record of that event, and that's partially the reason.
We're going to take another break here, and when we come back, I want to talk some more about your book, Reverend Morrison Reed. But before we do, in doing the research on the Selma Awakening, you're a scholar, a historian of your own denomination, but so I'm curious, what would you say was the major discovery, not only just about Unitarian Universalism and Selma, but Selma in general? Looking at this, what surprised you, that something you learned in researching the book you didn't know before?
That we thought of it as that one day or those couple of days.
Yeah.
In fact, its history was much longer. You actually had to go back to 1930 to understand, and that the momentum continued on, so that by 1972 you had five black city councilors in the city. So we focus on this one moment.
March of 65.
Right, but it actually, the span to understand it is much broader than that.
Okay, give me some of that when we get back. We'll take a short break here. Mark Morrison Reed, Reverend Morrison Reed, his book is The Selma Awakening, and Charles Blackburn, former Unitarian Universalist minister, is with us telling us about his experiences in Alabama in 1965. A short break on Midday. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Marches taking part in the Selma to Montgomery March of 1965, singing Come By Here, again a recording from the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage, recording made by an interior designer from Detroit named Carl Benkert, B-E-N-K-E-R-T, who went down to Selma with a reel-to-reel tape recorder and made those recordings that we're sharing with you in this hour of Midday. Charles Blackburn, Baltimorean and former. Actually, you don't live in Baltimore?
Floridian. I live in Baltimore since 1975.
Oh. Well, that's why I call you a Baltimorean.
Okay.
I mean, you're native Floridian.
Right.
Yeah, we get that. But I mean, if you've been here since 1975, I get to call you a Baltimorean.
Okay.
Anyway, and a former minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church. And speaking of Unitarian Universalism, our other guest, Reverend Dr. Mark Morrison Reed, whose book we're talking about in this hour of the show, The Selma Awakening, will be giving us a lecture tonight at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church of Baltimore. And that's located at Charles and Franklin Street, 7 p.m. There's information about that on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Now, I want to talk to you about Unitarian Universalism and race,
right,
and civil rights and equal rights. So there's a conflicted history there. And this book is called The Selma Awakening because they finally get the message, it seems like, right?
Right.
The leaders of your church.
Right.
What was going on before this? Say, take me back 100 years before that.
They were largely in New England.
Right.
Largely buffered from African-American community, would have had very little to do with African-Americans.
How old is the denomination?
It was found in 1825.
Where were they during the Civil War? Were they abolitionists?
Slowly they came to abolitionists. You always had a few heroes who were out in front who were major figures in the abolitionist movement, but most of them kind of hung back until the war was quickly approaching, and then they got on board.
Okay.
Any churches we had in the South at that point, the Unitarians, didn't survive the war, nary a one of them. You couldn't be Unitarian and be in the South.
What was the reaction in the Unitarian Church to Reverend Reeb's death?
Uniformly, there was a service, a memorial service. Uniformly, they raised money. Within months, they had raised $100,000 for him and used for Jimmie Lee Jackson and others. Uniformly, at some point in this, I would say somewhere upwards of a third of the ministers actually went south at some point. And if you looked at the ministers who did stuff in their own communities, we were talking about at least half the ministry. Now, this is not huge numbers, but we're talking about 400 people actively engaged in some sort of way. That this was a call to, I would say call to arms, but this was a call to action that they unequivocally responded to largely, even though a lot of our congregations were still in the Northeast and untouched. So it was not an issue for a lot of Unitarians because either they were in the suburbs or they were in New England, and you know New England. That's
right.
Not a lot of African Americans in Vermont and New Hampshire.
In Massachusetts. Yeah.
Right, or in Massachusetts.
Yeah, right.
So that's how that played out. And so that's why it just wasn't on the front of their agenda because there's no reason for them. But there always were Unitarian heroes. For instance, the NAACP was formed. There's five signatures. The NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, when it was founded in 1910, had five signatories. One of them was an African-American, W.E.B. Du Bois. The other were all white. And of those others, two were Unitarians, John Haynes Holmes and Mary White Ovington. So we always had visionaries that were plugged in progressive ways. But as a larger movement, it really wasn't on our screen.
Well, by the time we get to Selma and some leaders of the church are moved to go there and take part in these marches, they find an interfaith effort.
Oh, it was huge, huge.
Yeah, I think that's worth talking about a little bit.
There were Jews, there was Rabbi Herschel, there were Episcopalians, there were Catholics. I mean, it's fascinating. Catholics are supposed to check in with the local bishop. So the Catholics were supposed to be going to the Bishop of Alabama and asking his permission. They knew if they talked to the Bishop of Alabama, he would say no. So they did not follow the normal protocol. The Episcopalians, before the march on that Tuesday, wanted to have communion. They were blocked from having communion.
In a church or out on the street?
In Episcopal, they wanted to go to the Episcopal church, to those who come, to have communion.
In Selma.
In Selma, and they were blocked from having that. They sent the sheriff, chief of police.
That's very interesting. The
minister asked the chief of police, the minister of the local Episcopal church asked the chief of police to stop the other Episcopalians, the hundreds of them, from having communion in his church. So they went back to Brown Chapel.
He thought that would just lead to more trouble.
Right.
And Brown Chapel, now that's a reference to Dr. King spoke at Brown Chapel. Right.
Everyone, it was the center. You have to, once you've been in Selma, so Brown Chapel AME was in the middle of this compound of the Carver Homes, and that's what's made it safe because the entire neighborhood around it was African American. And so they could be there and be contained and be safe and not subject to this harassment, which, as Charles talked about, you need to think of this as akin to terrorism I mean, that's the way we talk today. If you look at what's going on, it was terrorism that was aimed at keeping African Americans in place and Northerners away. There's fascinating. So the rabbis came down. Who else? There's this one story I heard that at one point there were atheists who went as well, and they came up with $5,000, and they came on this rally. When they came, the guy came down almost defiantly because it's very religious. It came down and said, "Well, here's $5,000 from the atheists," and the minister was receiving it without missing a beat. Said, "And are there any other atheists here with $5,000?"
All are welcome.
It was yeah. Wildly ecumenical, wildly ecumenical.
Let me tell a little ecumenical story. After Bloody Sunday, when I got back to Huntsville, I called. There was a very courageous white Catholic mission priest in Selma. And I called him and said, "What's going on?" And he said, "Well, they're conducting nonviolent workshops, King's Group, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, right after this tremendous provocation to violence of the Bloody Sunday." And he was amazed, and I was amazed at him, and that he had was allowing them to use his facility and was supporting them.
You know, for those who aren't familiar with the history, we ought to just briefly talk about Bloody Sunday a bit. Maybe not the movie version of this, but right. The actual historic version.
So they did. Again, it was Sunday, March 7th. They set out in the afternoon to the William Pettus Bridge. They were going to march to Montgomery in protest of Jimmie Lee Jackson's murder and for voting rights. They got to the bridge, and they were attacked by vigilantes and the Alabama State Troopers, who just slaughtered them. Subsequently, King called clergy from all over the country. They came. The second march was on March 9th. They turned around to the bridge. There was a court injunction against it. King did not want to break the court injunction.
That was a state court, right?
No, that was a federal
court.
Was
that a federal court?
That was a federal court injunction.
Wow.
So they came and they turned around, went back and said, "We're going to wait and we will march, but we want to wait till the injunction is lifted."
Wow.
It was while they were in that process of waiting that James Reeb was killed, was beaten, and then later
it was during
died.
That period.
Then they were there for weeks before the injunction was lifted.
And then it was lifted by, what action lifted it?
Federal Judge Johnson lifted
same
it.
Another
one
judge.
Who had made it. Same one made it, lifted it.
Oh,
lifted
he
it.
Was convinced and, that this and, was a violation and, of First Amendment, right?
And
right?
told him, told Wallace, "You not only have to let them march, you have to protect them." Mm. Wallace balked at that, and at that point, Johnson called in federal troops and federal marchers to protect the marchers.
Thank you for that. And Mark Morrison Reed, your comments about Selma the movie, you've made some references to it here during this hour, but I'm sure our listeners are curious. As a historian, having written a book about this period,
If you don't look at the details, it works.
Right. It's because there were some issues raised, especially its portrayal of Lyndon Johnson.
So why don't you speak to that, Charles? Because you were just speaking admiringly of Johnson.
Yes, I had worked on Capitol Hill. I knew of his work. I knew he really gave up his political future for the
for civil rights,
for the Civil Rights
and the Voting
Act
Rights
in
Act.
64.
Yeah.
Because he knew he would have no more support from the South to do that. And I just felt it was very unfair in the film.
Because this was the second bill. This was not the first bill.
Right.
The first bill was 64, which was filibustered, which they finally got through. Then they had the Voting Rights Act. So he had asked, this was not some sudden revelation he had. So that's a part of the misportrayal of Johnson here.
And Charles Blackburn, I wonder if you could just make real for our listeners what it was like to try to vote in the South if you were a black person prior to that time. The stories you heard from people there in your organizing.
Unbelievable. In Magnolia, Mississippi, where I went to the voter registration drive, if you wanted to register to vote, you had to put in the newspaper, local newspaper, three times in a row, three different times, that you intended to register to vote. Well, when that happened, when a Negro did that, they would lose their job immediately. They would be evicted.
You had to put a notice in the newspaper.
You had to put a notice in
that you intended
three different times that you intended to register. I know you can't wrap your mind around
it. Did you have to pay for the notice?
Sure, of course.
Of course. Right.
Yeah, so you'd be evicted from your home. Any number of terrible things could happen to you. Very effective.
And that was local law.
Yes.
as a Magnolia ordinance.
When we went to register, we said, we want to see the registrar. And they said, he's not here. And I said, well, we will sit here until he's available to us. And that's when they arrested us for trespassing on the courthouse grounds.
Oh, you mentioned that earlier.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, Mark Morrison Reed, a story from Unitarian Universalism, a revelation for you in doing your research on Selma. You mentioned James Reeb, of course, became a martyr in this because of his death. But what about the other leaders who got down there?
What struck me is that uniformly, if you talk to Charles, went to Howard, was at a black wedding. Orloff Miller,
who was beaten,
had actually been with an interracial couple the night when they watched that together. His roommate at Boston University had been a black man. Clark Olson, the other person who was beaten, one of his best friends when he went to Harvard Divinity School, who he'd worked with as a student minister, was a black man. If you looked pretty uniformly, these people had all, over the course of time, developed significant relationships to African Americans. And so when this happened, this wasn't about somebody else. This wasn't about somebody else's friend. Mm. This was actually about
their friends.
This was about their friends.
Yeah.
That's a whole different thing. There's something completely compelling about that. This was not a big choice. Clark will say, I decided to go. Of course he decided to go. I think that was the revelation. We talk about the ideology. We talk about the cause. This was about having significant human relationships to people who were being oppressed.
That's the evil of segregation, isn't it? What it does to people,
right.
How it isolates people.
And how you keep from one another. And so, right, they look at you as beast or some other. That's how they have to rationalize it, is to say you're fundamentally other, you're not of us, and we're going to keep you in your place. Well, how do you do that? You treat them as not human.
Has anyone done such a history before of your church?
No.
How has it been received?
This, they tell me it's selling quite well.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Right.
Okay.
They tell me it's selling quite well. I've spent 30 years.
Maybe far enough away from the history. You know, if you had done this maybe 30 or
years ago. I couldn't have done it 30 years ago. I've been wrestling with this myself for a long time. So just briefly, the odd thing about me, of course, is I was 15 when this all happened. And no one will believe this, but I was sitting in a Swiss boarding school.
Excuse me, I'm going to have a hard time believing. Actually, I'm flattering you. You're 65?
I'm 65.
Oh. My father's
a scientist, and the family was in Switzerland. And I watched this all in a boarding school with Israelis and Germans and Swiss and Dutch. And a school is called École de Humanité, School of Humanity, and we lived together. Yeah, we lived together in love. I have massive confusion. You have to understand the massive confusion of watching this and not being able to reconcile it with my life and the people I knew, and spending years trying to come to terms with what happened and feeling guilty that I was so privileged.
Yeah.
And others were dying and marching and being beaten.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of this, in hindsight, I realize was not just getting the information, but emotionally trying to come to terms with what happened for myself.
Thank you very much. It was nice to have you on our show today. Mark Morrison Reed, his book, The Selma Awakening, How the Civil Rights Movement Tested and Changed Unitarian Universalism. He'll be speaking about this tonight at First Unitarian Church of Baltimore, which is located at Charles and Franklin Streets. I assume there's no tickets. You just walk into the church, sit down, and listen to the lecture. It's at 7 p.m. at, Charles and Franklin Street. And Charles, speaking of Charles Blackburn, nice to have you on the show today and relating your experiences with us. And still a member of the Unitarian Universalism.
I am indeed.
Yeah, I thought so. Thank you very much. It was nice to meet you and have you on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Dan.
And thanks, everybody, for tuning into our first hour of midday. Special thanks to Carl Benkert years ago for making those recordings that we used during the during this hour, again, from the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage. We'll take a break here. We have lunch on Tuesday from Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby building near Harbor East. Open daily 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with delivery nightly 5 to 9 p.m. Thanks for providing lunch for our guests. We'll see you after the news for the second hour.